If an engagement ring is actually the symbol of a power of love and you're thinking about getting one, go see our friends over at Robert Irwin Jewelers. Why might you ask? Because get more choices over at Robert Irwin Jewelers. They have a large collection of natural and lab-grown diamonds. They also make designing your custom-made engagement ring risk-free and easy. You can do so with a peace of mind with a meant-to-be guarantee. That means that for any reason, if you're unhappy with your purchase, you have a full 365 days to return it. If you can dream it, Robert Irwin Jewelers can make it. They can even make your engagement ring from something as simple as a picture or a drawing, even a dream that you might have. Robert Irwin Jewelers also offers free ring sizing for life, as well as the free jewelry spa service for life. They also have great financing options. You can ask her now and pay later with 24 months deferred interest, or you can take up to 60 months to pay at a low APR. Robert Irwin Jewelers has over 4 decades of experience in the jewelry business, and they've become a trusted name known for providing timeless treasures for generations of families. Go check out the Diamond Showroom over on Perkins Extended across from Laurelwood. You can also check out the Bartlett location on Stage Road right next to the Kroger. And also, they will be soon opening their brand new South Haven location. Bigger, brighter diamonds, better prices, all at Robert Irwin Jewelers. You can also shop online at rijewelers.com. Jason Munns is the Tiger basketball beat writer for The Commercial Appeal. You can follow him on the Everything app at Munsley. Munns, what are we listening to?
Who on earth doesn't know this is Huey Lewis in the News, The Power of Love, man? It's in my mind, the single greatest American musician in history.
Huey Lewis is...
No, I mean, I'm not going to go that far, but it's certainly very special to me. Our good boy, we named our good boy Huey after Huey Lewis. Mm-hmm. So this is... That's a nod to him.
Mad respect. I mean that seriously, because it does feel like Huey Lewis is one of the rare combinations of he can have hits, and I feel like even music people appreciate him.
Yeah, I want to say, gosh, there was some interview I saw with somebody recently. Maybe it was a member of Pearl Jam, or maybe it was a member of the Black Rose, or something like that. It was just, or Foo Fighters, or somebody. I don't know. It was somebody who was just going on and on about him and or about the band and everything. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of a dual thing because the traveling version of Back to the Future, the musical, was just at the Orpheum.
Oh, yeah.
My wife and I went and saw it, and it was wonderful. And that obviously that song is from that great movie. So, yeah, I mean, like, it's just yeah, you could pick 100 different songs, but yeah, they're great.
Is Master P going to be the GM for the Tigers?
No, he is not. That is, you know, what's so funny about that is, so I had heard, I was talking to somebody last week who mentioned him and mentioned the GM job at Memphis in the same breath. And I hadn't heard anything about it up to that point. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they go, well, yeah, apparently he just gave an interview in the last couple of days saying that he, not only was he interested in the Arizona State head job, which obviously makes you laugh a little bit, but he also, you know, in the same conversation brought up the fact that Memphis has a lot going on with its coaching staff and yeah, I mean, he kind of brought it up himself, and I'm thinking, okay, all right, fine, sure. Well, then the next morning, last week, the news breaks that he stepped down from his position as, president of basketball operations.
Yeah, we were trying to go over his title. Yeah, I think it was a president of basketball operations.
Yeah, but also assistant coach. Like, he was in the huddle when UNO came to Memphis. So he was, like, definitely on the bench. That was not just an honorary thing. Like, he was involved. And so I start thinking about it. Like, okay, he just resigned. He's talking about it publicly. He's got history with the city of Memphis. Obviously, he got the key to the city back in 2005. He was just here and did a lot of handshaking and picture taking. And I want to say even while he was here, he did some charity work or some philanthropic work. And so, you know, I'm starting to add everything up, and certainly Memphis has a need for somebody with a sharp business mind and deep pockets. And I'm just like, okay, all right, maybe let's do some digging and see what's up. And so, you know, it does sound a little far-fetched, and it is. So sadly it is. No Master P.
All right. So Jason, hey, it's David Cobb again.
Oh my goodness, David Cobb. Wow. Just like somebody needs to warn me from now on. Like,
well, it's all Cobb's
fault. Every week thing?
It's all Cobb's fault. No, this is probably the last time for a while. He's big time in us.
No.
He's covering the Final Four.
Oh, well. Oh, David. I'm so happy to hear your voice.
You should tell Jeffrey that moving forward, you want to be the Thursday guest so you and I can converse every week. I mean, not that we couldn't converse privately, but
we could.
It's great to be with you. And my question is, Jason, okay, so it's not Master P. Really, my question is more so when than who. Like, if you want to tell us who, then go ahead. But, like, when is this GM going to be hired? Because I'm just kind of looking around at the calendar, at the watch, seeing 800-plus players now in the portal and thinking, okay, if this person is going to help assemble next season's roster, boy, man, we got to get something here soon, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from where I sit, I truly believe it's already done. It's just a matter of an announcement being made. My understanding is that that the person they have chosen has been, you know, kind of an agreement has been made and work has begun. It's just that they have not gone public with it yet. And I think part of that is the fact that, you know, they've had this, the new women's coach, obviously her press conference, her formal introductory press conference was today. Hannah Hayden is the new women's basketball coach. And you don't ever want to upstage that. And then, you know, of course you've had some other transactions, some other moves that have, happened in recent days. And yeah, they just, from my understanding, they weren't exactly ready to make the announcement yet. But I mean, at the same time, you know, it was said more than 10 days ago that there was a 7 to 10 day window that they wanted this to be a done deal. And like I said, I think it is a done deal. It's just a matter of announcing it. So if I were predicting, I'll bet it's announced tomorrow or Friday. I do not see this going into next week.
One thing we do not have to wait on was the announcement of Tony Madlock as the associate head coach, Sean Mock, and Trevor Deloach as the assistants for the 26-27 season. Should these hires be viewed as encouraging?
Well, it depends. I would say, you know, on a case-by-case basis, I would say Tony Madlock certainly is encouraging. You know, you're talking about a guy with decades of experience. Obviously, he's a Memphian. He has a very, very strong relationship with Penny. If there's anybody who, you know, you could pick to be, like, the best suited to be Penny Hardaway's right-hand man, it's Tony Madlock. And I think, you know, he is going to – you know, I talked to him earlier this week the day he, you know, like officially started. And, you know, one of the things that he really stressed to me was he was like, I feel like a pretty good assistant. I'm going to be a better assistant now that I've been a head coach for 5 seasons. And so, you know, when he's talking about how Penny is a better coach than he was 5 seasons ago when Tony left, or yeah, five years ago when Tony left. And so, you know, you certainly, think that you know, you can buy all that is a really, really good move, and especially making him the associate head coach is a really good move. And then the others, you know, they're it's harder to gauge with those two just because, you know, they have no connection to Memphis, either one of them really. You know, one is a little younger than the other, a little less experienced than the other. Talking about Deloach is the less experienced. He's only and less experienced in the American. Yes, he's been in the American, but only for the past 2 seasons and only at UTSA and Charlotte. Hasn't had a ton of success, even though he has had experience in the American. Sean Mock has, on the flip side, been in the American for 7 seasons, all with Ron Hunter, very good coach. So you feel like you feel good about that he's worked under a you know, somebody for so long who's pretty good at what they do, even if the results haven't exactly blown you away since he's gotten to Tulane. You think he knows what he's doing and you know, has gone about things the right way, and that's permeated to the people who've been around him. But what I say, you know, about those two specifically is we got to wait until we see whether bringing them in, you know, what that does from a roster building standpoint. Does bringing Sean Mock, who has coached Rowan Brumbaugh for the past 2 seasons and others, he's coached Curtis Williams Jr., who's a really, you know, who was a pretty good player for Tulane this past season. Like, do those relationships pay off? I mean, it's already been reported that Brumbaugh is going into the transfer portal once it opens. You know, he was the preseason player of the year in the conference this past season. Memphis has done that before, where they've gone and gotten players from within the conference who've had great success, pointing at P.J. Haggerty and Kendrick Davis specifically, both guards. So, you know, the jury's still out a little bit on Mock and Deloach. And Deloach is kind of the same way. He's coming from Charlotte. Does his relationship, Memphis needs a big. Memphis needs a guard first and foremost, but they also need a big, and Charlotte has a big, Anton Bonk, 7'2", who, you know, is more than likely going to go in the portal when it opens. So, like, does having Deloach on your staff, does that help Memphis in its pursuit of a big man? We'll see.
Should anyone make anything of the fact that, you know, it's being reported that Sean Mock will be offensive coordinator? I don't know if it's been reported, but that's the speculation, that he's the offensive coordinator. And only once Tulane has had a better offense than Memphis. Is that, like, a fair critique?
Probably. I mean, yeah, I would say it's fair. You know, I mean, it's... if that is indeed the case, you know, because again, Memphis is bringing in Tony Madlock. Memphis obviously has Penny Hardaway at the helm. Memphis runs a very, you know, an offense that doesn't exactly, you know, like there's a lot of freedom. Penny Hardaway gives his offense, his players, a lot of freedom on offense. And so, you know, even if somebody is quote unquote going to be the offensive coordinator, what does that mean? What does that look like with a Penny Hardaway coach team? Like, we know what it might look. If Sean Mock was the offensive coordinator at Tulane, we know what it looks like at Tulane. We don't know necessarily what it would look like, you know, at Memphis under Penny Hardaway with Memphis players. You know, I think we'll just have to, you know, again, wait and see on that one. First, wait and see if that's going to be the case. And then second, wait and see if it's going to, you know, look like what it looked like at Tulane.
Kind of the follow-up, though, I was thinking about this. Obviously, it's probably not an either or. And when you go 13 and 19, it's both. But as someone who covers the program and basically has covered pretty much the entirety of the era, do you think that they have a bigger scheme problem or a roster problem right now?
Well, I mean, specifically this past season, it was a roster problem, if you ask me. I mean, you know, like, I think what Penny has shown over the years is that if he gets the right players, like if he gets the roster part right, the scheme part will follow. And I just think he got the roster wrong this past season. From a variety, like that's a very layered, nuanced thing, getting the roster wrong. I mean, you know, like I feel like I'm one of the only ones who feels this way. Like, I still believe, despite everything, despite how it all looked, despite the 13-19 this past season, I still believe that there was talent. Like, this was a talented roster. When Penny, in hindsight, I'm not so sure that you know, because so much was made when Penny said that this is the second most talented roster that he's had since he's been at Memphis and this and that. He said that before the season. You know, a lot's been made of that in the aftermath of this season. And I'm not so sure that I would go that far. But I would say that it's at least in the top half of the eight seasons, of the eight rosters that he's had. Like, I still think that was a talented roster that he had. It just didn't work. Like, there just weren't enough players on that roster who were committed to winning, who knew how to lead, who knew how, who knew what it took to, you know, to gel and be a cohesive unit. Like, 2 years ago with Tyrese Hunter and PJ Haggerty and Dane Danes and Colby Rogers and Nick Jordan and Musa Cisse, like, those guys knew, you know, sometimes Tyrese Hunter had to lead. Sometimes Dane Danger had to lead. And when Dane Danger had to lead, Tyrese Hunter knew how to pull back. And, you know, Nick Jordan, you know, sometimes he needed to score 15 points. More often than not, he didn't. But, like, he knew, you know, he kind of knew, like, night to night, whether he needed to be a defensive guy or a rebounder guy or, like, you know what I mean? Like,
dirty work guy. Yeah, no, I mean, I always thought the irony was, I never got the sense that, like, Jordan was the top priority of bringing back for that team last season. And while, obviously, he was nowhere near as significant as Tyrese, as PJ and Dane were, like, I think he's the next most significant.
Yeah, well, especially because they and I think he became even more significant when Tyreek Smith, we all remember, yep, Tyreek Smith, who left the day before the season started. I think Nick's value shot through the roof when Tyreek Smith left because they just didn't have anybody like that on that roster. And you need to have somebody. That's what I'm saying. When you're putting together a roster, you need to have guys like that. And I just don't think they had anybody like that on this team. So, you know, if you're asking which is the bigger problem, to me, the bigger problem is the roster. Like, you've got to get that right before you can ever even have a shot with a scheme. Like, you can scheme up all you want, but if the roster doesn't work, and it did not work, no matter how much talent there was, I mean, because again, like, we could talk about it, like, Doug's a talented player. Doug McDaniel, I still believe Zach Davis is a talented player. Hassan Abdul-Hakim, before he disappeared or got kicked off the team, I mean, mid-season for the second year in a row, two different programs. Before that, like, he is a talented player. It just didn't all it did not work, and so that's why I say, like, it's more of a roster problem at Memphis. They've got to make sure that they get that right, and if they do, if they do, we've seen that Penny Hardaway scheme, you can have success with it for sure.
No, because, like, along the same lines, I was telling Cobb this. If I'm breaking down the coaching additions on paper, like, and just set aside names and just use profiles, okay, we have an associate head coach that has ties to the school that might have been leaving a job before the Sharks get him, but he's done a good job at that school. Okay, pretty solid hire. And then your other two are assistant coaches that were part of staffs that got fired. Like, that's not really inspiring. At the same time, if they nail on three or four of these transfer portals, like, I think that matters way more than who they hired in a, you know, a uncomfortable offseason.
Yeah, without a doubt. And you know, you got to – It's not a complete staff rebuild at Memphis. You do still have people who Andre Turner is still going to be around. and those sorts of things. So it's not a complete, total rebuild. But yes, it's all about the roster. It really and truly is. Like, there's never been, I don't think, and we've seen the proof of that just this past season. Like, Memphis had it rolling. This time last year, Memphis was coming off its best season in a decade and a half, and then they got the roster wrong. And then they had the worst season in 56 years. So, like, you have to get the roster right. That to me, is like, it's as important and perhaps more important now than maybe ever.
Well, we got one answer anyway on next year's roster. It sounds like Curtis Givens won't be a part of it. Curious, because it seems like, you know, hey, local kid, showed some promise over the course of the season. But maybe if I'm reading the tea leaves, it's like, all right, Curtis Givens profiles as like a lead guard who could probably have the ball in his hands quite a bit. But Memphis, you know, its best successes have come with a P.J. Haggerty or a Kendrick Davis. You want to maybe be shooting for that caliber of lead guard. And, you know, Curtis Givens, though he showed flashes this year, if he wants that showcase role, you know, maybe Memphis isn't the place for him to get it.
Yeah, I mean, he did some good stuff. He was, I think, the third leading scorer on the team. You know, averaged right around just a shade under 10 points a game. He was the had the number one 3-point field goal percentage on the team. So you know, certainly a player who can add value to your team, but it just, for whatever reason, it just never seemed to click. He never seemed to be able to settle into a groove. He was hurt a little bit. You know, he missed 7 games for a variety of reasons, including injury. And you know, he was in the starting lineup sometimes. He was not in the starting lineup sometimes. Obviously, that was, so much was made of that this season about how many different starting lineups that Penny used. And you feel like that didn't necessarily do Curtis any favors, but like, his decision making was questionable. His passing needed some work. His defense certainly wasn't outstanding. And so, yeah, like, it felt like, I'll say that, like, when he committed and came, you know, it was clear that he was coming to Memphis last offseason. You know, I remember thinking to myself, like, I don't know if. You know, he Memphis wanted him out of high school, out of Montverde, and he chose to go to LSU. And not saying that that's like a reason to be like skeptical, but I think that's certainly part of the calculus, at least how I was thinking about it. And you know, it just, for whatever reason, you know, you got the there's politics that are involved when you have high profile players from the city. That can be, you know, problematic sometimes. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. And yeah, it just felt like, not only with him, but also with Ashton, it just felt like it was best for both sides, because Ashton Hardaway is leaving too. If for anybody who didn't know, he's expected to go into the portal when it opens here in a few days too. But yeah, it just felt like both of those guys, it was best for everyone involved to, you know, amicably part ways and see what can happen without each other.
We're talking with Jason Munns here, the Tiger basketball beat writer for the Commercial Appeal. And then also today, the University of Memphis introduced their new women's basketball coach, Hannah Hayden. You referenced it earlier. What do we know about Hannah?
She is a very young head coach. I mean, she's young, but she has been a head coach for, I think, 10 seasons now at various levels, junior college, NAIA, or maybe Division II, and Division I. And she turned around a Georgia Southern program in just 2 seasons that, you know, hadn't really, like, they did some stuff at Georgia Southern, or she did some stuff at Georgia Southern that had not been done in like this century. And yeah, like, she's just shown that she can win no matter where she goes so far. That doesn't always mean that, you know, that's always going to continue, but yeah, she, I talked to her as well earlier this week, and she obviously was introduced today during her introductory press conference. And, you know, she talked a lot about how both with me and at the press conference about how she's like, she's going to hang her hat on defense. Her teams are always going to get after you on defense. She was talking earlier today about how defense never goes into a slump. Defense always travels. You know, those cliches you hear. She's like a big preacher of those things. You know, and one of the things I thought was really funny. I was talking to her and she was telling me about some of her influences and things like that. And she was telling me about this guy she played for at the junior college level up in Missouri. And she was telling me that it was his last season and it was her first season at a different junior college. And they met in the region tournament semifinals. And, you know, if her team had won, it was going to be his last game. And her team was heavy underdogs. The way she explained it to me was, we sucked. And I thought that was really interesting, but her team ended up winning by 1 point, and it sent one of her mentors into retirement with a loss from a player that he had coached before. And I actually caught up to him. His name's Gary Koch. And he was like, that was one of those things that makes you cry in your beer.
Yeah.
And he was like, he was telling me, one of the things he said was, he actually got a little bit annoyed with her because before and during the game, she was like glaring at his bench. Like,
love it.
Actively giving them the stink eye. And he was like, I don't really like that. And he's never forgotten it. So, but he said all that to say that that's the type of coach you're getting in Memphis.
Jason, we appreciate my man.
Thanks, Cobb.
That is Jason Munns, Tiger basketball beat writer for the Commercial Appeal. Do you know what ghost transfers are?
I feel like I'm about to learn something to do with one of these new rules that just got passed.
Yes, some of these new rules that will almost assuredly get challenged in court. We'll tell you about it, the latest updates, as we try to understand the world of college athletics. Ross Dellinger over at Yahoo's got a story about perhaps fines, head coach suspensions, everything that could come with ghost transfers. We'll tell you all about it next, right here on Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
All right, Cobb, I'm sure you'll get more scuttlebutt when you get to Indianapolis, but the NCAA has released the D1 cabinet adopts new rules to address ghost transfers for all sports. On Wednesday, the Division I cabinet adopted a proposal that penalizes programs that sign a transfer student athlete. Oh, we're still doing that. And adding a transfer student athlete to a roster or allow a transfer student athlete to participate in athletically related activities before the student athlete has entered into the NCAA transfer portal. Penalties, which are automatically triggered, include a suspension of the respective sports head coach for 50% of a season and a fine of 20% of that sport's budget. The rule change, which was initially proposed by the Football Bowl Subdivision Oversight Committee, has been adopted for all sports in Division I, is effective immediately, and applies to all transfers on or after February the 25th of 2026. So, breaking this down, this is the NCAA response, right, to the scuttlebutt that in May, players will unenroll and then I suppose enter the transfer portal. Is that the distinction?
The Jake Retzlaff loophole where he got dismissed or unenrolled or whatever at BYU. And then he ends up playing at Tulane because he never entered the portal. He just showed up, said, all right, I'm not a student at this other school. Now I want to be a student here. Who needs the portal? But Jeffrey, this is going to get challenged.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the first question is, all right, does a player challenge or does a coach challenge first?
It'll be the recommended lawyers from whatever student athlete gets kicked out of a school in May or June and then wants to go play somewhere in August.
I think you're right. It's got to be a player, right? Because the coach is an employee of the NCAA institution. And I guess
they're trying to deter you from challenging it because they're trying to put pretty significant penalties on coaches who play these guys. I mean, 50% of the season for playing a transfer who enrolled outside of a portal window. I mean, I think
the 20% of the budget is just as big. That's a huge salary cap hit. Revenue sharing hit.
Right. Yeah, no, it is. So the NCAA is trying to have teeth here. They're trying to make it so the penalty is so steep that like schools won't even mess with it and won't even want to risk challenging it. Because on the off chance the NCAA were to win one of these cases and these penalties were to be upheld by a court, 20% of your budget, half the season for the head coach, that's catastrophic.
And I don't know. I mean, I feel like this is just going to get challenged this summer, right?
Well, if somebody's willing to, like, if they think their case is good enough, like, you would have to be a really important player. It would have to be like a Retzloff level player. Like, hey, this guy could change our entire season, our whole trajectory. I mean, you think about how much better Tulane was with Jake Retzloff than they would have been without him. They make the playoff, right? They don't make the playoff without. I mean, I'm not saying he was a.
No, you know, he was better than Brandon Sullivan.
Yeah, for sure. So it's like, what player are we talking about? Are they worth it? Because these penalties are no joke.
Right, but if you go through, like, let's use this example. You go through spring, and you realize that you're thin. You're not good at a position group. Like, I don't, like, we know tampering is happening. Like, to me, like, you're just going to see players that are going to go, all right, well, this school's going to offer me this. I'm going to unenroll and transfer. And as soon as basically I would presume, then you're going to have legal filings.
Right. Well,
and then the first question will be temporary injunction, right?
The TRO. Yeah. Now I do wonder though, is the NCAA starting to pick up a little momentum in court? Like, not on Trinidad Chambliss. No,
I don't think
they're on Charles Mediaco. They did.
I don't think they're picking up momentum on freedom of movement. I think they're picking up momentum on eligibility.
Right.
I should. That's very unclear. Length of guys that are essentially challenging to just keep playing.
Well, so they lost on Chambliss, but.
Yeah. It feels like where they are picking up steam is guys that actively or knew that their eligibility was up, yet challenging the system to keep playing. There was enough murkiness on Chambliss that I could see where he had a case. But it's interesting to me, like, if Trinidad makes it through the season, does he keep the lawsuit going?
Well, what would his case be after this season?
Well, I do think, George, step in here. Didn't Trinidad also, I think Trinidad also added, I don't know if he's filing a new lawsuit or he added to the lawsuit that he was one of the players that was going to be considered to be the cover of NCAA. And because the NCAA took so long ruling on his case, that they penalized him for making money that way.
That sounds familiar. It wouldn't shock me after the story and with the timing of when those games come out. What, like, he's not actually in the game, period, as far as I know. So he couldn't even sign up for the individual payout from EA, let alone being a cover athlete.
So the only way to play him is when a roster update?
Right. If they're even able to do that because the payouts have already been sent out from EA.
Now,
well, if Trinidad Chambliss ain't in it, I ain't buying it.
Well, I mean,
that's a lie. That's a lie.
I was about to say.
I guess, though, it is fair to say this, though. Preventing him from making money is also not. Like, the NCAA essentially ruled him ineligible. If
throughout the course of the trial, the jury or the judge also said, no, your eligibility was expired, even though it was complicated. Does that create the grounds for the NCAA maybe having a better stance and more power?
I don't know, but what I'm seeing in this thing today is basically the NCAA daring a school to call their bluff, daring a program out there to say, risk 20% of your football budget, risk 50% of your head coach's season to try to beat us in court. Like, I think that's the it's just a deterrent.
No,
right?
I totally agree with you on that. I am wondering if it is enough of a deterrent.
I think it would be. I mean, when you start messing with the wallet these days, that's. But all it takes is one loss, and then the whole rule is done. It's toast.
Correct.
Right. So, like, who's going to be the brave school? You know, who's going to be that one player who's worth it? Because this was going to be a loophole. Like, the Retzloff thing was going to become a recurring trend of players unenrolling and then re-enrolling without ever, quote, transferring, right? And so they're trying to get out in front of it to a certain degree, which, you know, obviously Retzloff set the initial precedent, or probably somebody else, but Retzloff's just the one that comes to mind as being most
yes.
significant. And so, you know, it's like, all right, we can't have that. Like, we can't have guys leaving a school in July and then showing up for fall camp at another program, like, because that'll become... Then the portal is just irrelevant. All of whatever semblance of quote rules we have right now completely fly out the window if the unenroll re-enroll thing becomes normalized. So, like, the NCAA, they are putting their chips in this basket in terms of their ability to rule college sports. And if this one breaks, like, look out. Like, it's game over. Like, it is game over, because the portal windows then become completely irrelevant.
Arbitrary. I mean, they're nothing yeah. more than words on a page. I guess this is what I find curious. Schools, players, etc., have consistently challenged the NCAA. We've not really seen schools sue the conferences. We're in this weird reality where conference rules feel like they're more enforceable, or maybe more of a deterrent than NCAA rules. And if you're Sankey or you're Petiti, why would you not impose, like, for instance, we had the Nico situation. Like, where I thought Nico and his camp were stupid transferring when they did, because the SEC had the rule that if you didn't transfer in the early window, you would not be eligible to play this season. And he took away some of the biggest bidders. Do I really think that Auburn would not have gotten into that sweepstakes? 100% do. Do I think other schools would have gotten into that sweepstakes? 100%. But it was almost like the SEC rule was more preventative or a bigger deterrent than even NCAA policy.
So, but which raises the question, what do Greg Sankey and Tony Petiti, how do they feel about this rule?
It's
if they don't like it.
No, it's my suspicion they probably do like it. It is also my suspicion that I think that maybe not forcing is the right word, because you can't force them to do anything. I think they are strongly encouraging the NCAA to get this aggressive again, like ramp up, show some teeth again, because I think they believe it's not going to hold up. And then that way, instead of having to break away and do their own thing and quote unquote kill the game, the NCAA hangs itself.
Whoa, I love that. That's some good stuff. Clip that one, because you might have just predicted the future there.
That's my suspicion.
Well, I mean, I think that's what it is, because when the portal breaks down, right? You know, there's very few things that the NCAA does anymore. One of the few things they do, aside from putting on a basketball championship, is it's called the NCAA transfer portal. Like, they've actually done, knock on wood, and this is going to be a huge test, a pretty decent job of creating a system. Now it's chaos, and I understand all that, and the bidding wars and all that. And that's the market. That's the market.
But that's not the system that you're talking about. Yeah.
But the NCAA itself has created this portal deal, right? And that's how players move about and whatever. So it's like, can you imagine if NBA free agency were to encounter a legal loophole, and then all of a sudden a guy could literally just go sign with any team at any time without any contractual, like, whatever stipulation? I mean, it would be absolutely insane. And if this law or this rule that the NCAA's passed today, right? Like if it gets that challenge, then it's going to be exactly what you said. It'll be the end of the NCAA, and the Big Ten and the SEC will go off and do their own thing. I mean, I don't think you're wildly off base.
This is what I struggle with. Okay. Let's say I'm too online and I'm doing too much of my own research, or whatever conspiratorial epitaph we grant to those types. Do Sankey and Petiti have an answer to the question of, in an ideal world, what is the role of the NCAA? Is it to run championships? What is it?
That's a great question. I think they find it increasingly irrelevant and useless. Unless the NCAA's power and the NCAA's strength and numbers and its visibility as a national organization, and that word is key, national organization, unless they were able to successfully lobby for governmental intervention, for antitrust / a congressional law. Right. But they failed to do that.
That's where I wonder, did the moment, even though it was misguided and I think it was a terrible strategy, the moment that it became clear they were not going to be able to get congressional aid, was that really the day that the NCAA's future was officially done?
Well,
like,
yes.
You can run out the clock and whatnot, but it's like, if they can't do that, then what purpose do they serve?
Well, they're still out here lobbing Hail Marys. It's sad. Like, it's really, it's pretty sad.
I mean, I guess you could make the argument the purpose that they serve is to run a moneymaker of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah. And they do that. It's been a great NCAA tournament. Ratings are up. Gee, what do you know? Ratings are up and everything. But I digress.
It's like called big data.
The NCAA still thinks that it's going to get congressional intervention. They do. Why? I don't know. Like, if you turn on the news, there's 1,000 other things going on.
I think it's simply, right? I think it's confirmation bias. I think they are paying lobbyists, and lobbyists are telling them, it's going to happen. And why are the lobbyists telling them that? Because they're paying them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that kind of cycle.
Yeah, I know. I don't think you're far off. But then you look at, if the SEC and the Big Ten were able to break away and do their own thing, well, what would prevent them from being challenged with any sort of rules or structure they put in place? The answer would have to be collective bargaining.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it would have to be. And the NCAA refuses to go down that route. But if the Big Ten and the SEC got to a point where they were fed up with the NCAA, they might have to say, you know what, we're going to do our own thing. We're going to have a collectively bargained agreement with the players, and that's going to be the future for us, and y'all can figure out the rest.
All right, my man, safe travels to Indy. Good luck covering the tournament.
All right, man, appreciate it.
That is David Cobb of CBS Sports. When we come back, we tell your story next, right here on Jeff Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. All right, George, for today's Don't Tell These Story, tell your story. Dan Hurley went on the Triple Option podcast to address the chest bump seen around the world, which was another instance in which Duke wanted a technical foul called. Here was what Dan had to say about the incident. Really, at that point in the game, we just had it won. And Roger Ayers, the official, is such an easy guy to work with during the game that I thought he was coming over to chest bump me to celebrate the shot.
What?
Could you imagine the reaction if a ref chest bumped a coach after winning?
Oh.
I will say, my God. He also went into like how he was just like hyped from the. I do think he was in that mode because I defended them on Monday. Right. He was just looking for people to chest bump.
Oh, like I genuinely think.
And Ayers happened to be the next guy that was there.
He was just looking around at.
Yes.
I don't think he actually saw that it was. I just think he just saw human shape.
just looking to chest bump.
My thanks to Jason Munns for joining the program. If you missed anything, it'll be up on the podcast shortly after the program ends. For George, for Cobb, this is Jeffrey saying thanks for listening. Keep listening. The Gabe Kuhn Show is coming up next.